4, Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Voting in a long-awaited election for a new parliament opens Sunday in half of Egypt's provinces, and the government works to complete a roadmap to democracy implemented following the ouster of Mohamed Morsi as president. The first phase involves 14 provinces voting Sunday and Monday, and the remaining areas go to the polls in early December. Egyptians living abroad had the chance to vote on Saturday. The current leader, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, led the effort in 2013 to topple Morsi, the country's first-backed, democratically elected president. That brought a military-backed interim government with the promise of a new constitution and elections for a new president and parliament. Iran and world powers involved in nuclear talks reached a milestone Sunday that sets the stage for the eventual lifting of Tehran's nuclear-related sanctions. The two sides dubbed October 18th as Adoption Day. That's the day when the parties involved began taking steps to carry out the provisions of the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The next date for the milestone is Implementation Day, and that has yet to be determined. A U.S.-led coalition airstrike has killed a top al-Qaeda-linked militant in northwest Syria, according to the Pentagon Sunday. Saudi national Sanafi al-Nasser was killed Thursday, according to the Pentagon. He was described as a member of the so-called Khorasan group and longtime jihadist who handled finances between donors and various al-Qaeda operations. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said in a statement that al-Nasser's death deals a significant blow to the Khorasan group's plans. VOA News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is meeting with Turkish leaders Sunday in an effort to secure their country's help in stemming the flow of migrants into Europe. Merkel met with Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu in his office in Istanbul ahead of meeting President Tayyip Erdogan scheduled for later in the day. In a news conference following his meeting with Merkel, Davutoğlu said that Turkey is ready to work with Germany on preventing illegal migration, but the crisis cannot be resolved without a solution to the conflict in Syria. At least four Israeli cities, including the commercial capital of Tel Aviv, have temporarily banned Arab laborers from working in their schools as they struggle to calm public fears fueled by the worst surge of Palestinian street attacks in years. Israel's cabinet also imposed more security measures Sunday after further Palestinian stabbings this weekend, widening police stop and frisk powers that will effectively allow them to search anyone on the street. A crawling typhoon with cloud cover spanning 600 kilometers is blanketing the northern half of the Philippines, with one officially confirmed death. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
Typhoon Kopu is packing gusts of up to 185 kilometers per hour as it makes slow progress toward the northernmost Philippines. State forecaster Manny Mendoza says since Kopu is progressing at just 5 kilometers per hour, the Weather Service revised its expected exit from land to Thursday instead of Tuesday. Mendoza says heavy to intense rain will continue in bursts in the mountainous provinces on the north and north-central part of the Philippines' main island of Luzon. Forecasters say this is causing flash flooding and landslides. The winds have uprooted trees, knocked out power, and blown off lightweight rooftops. Power company workers are trying to restore electricity to at least 24 municipalities. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Sunday lobbied for the United States to be reelected to UNESCO's board, promising to work with Congress to restore funding after Washington cut off its contributions in protest over the Palestinians being admitted as full members. The United States and Israel in 2013 lost their UNESCO voting rights in the UN agency's 195-member assembly 2 years after suspending their financial contributions to the organization. Air France will cut less than a third of the 2,900 job cuts it proposed in 2016-2017 that triggered clashes with some staff. That's according to the chief executive of the parent company, Air France KLM, said on Sunday. The job cuts in 2016 would be voluntary. This is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We had a briefing meeting yesterday whereby we had more than 104 observers from various observer missions. We were just briefing them on what we have done and what we expect.
Over 140 international poll observer groups will monitor the upcoming elections in Tanzania.
What has happened on Friday is that the National Liberation Council was convened in order to restructure the party in anticipation of registration that is going to take place under the Political Parties Act 2012.
The South Sudanese ruling SPLM party dissolves its party leadership.
She should be brought to order. She is the wife of the president of this country, and we expect her to lead by example, to respect the electorate.
And Zimbabweans say they are unhappy about the outbursts of First Lady Grace Mugabe at public functions. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A prominent official of the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania says more than 140 international poll observer missions are in the country to monitor the upcoming October 25th presidential, parliamentary and local elections. Tanzania has 22 registered parties under the Political Parties Act of 1992. Emmanuel Kaweshi, the director of the Legal Services Department of the Electoral Commission, told me that political parties have met all legal requirement necessary to allow them to campaign and be part of the upcoming vote.
All the political parties which are participating in the election rallies, they all met the criteria or the legal requirements, because before they are nominated to run for any post, they have to fulfill the legal requirements. So to say, if you see that a candidate is there in the rally, bear in mind that he has met the criteria required. So all those who are contesting right now, they managed to make it on 21st August when it was the nomination day. And it was from 22nd to 24th, they are on the ground doing their campaigns, save for the constituencies and wards where the candidates passed their way. But the others are okay and are proceeding.
We have heard about a meeting between Electoral Commission officials and international poll observers who are currently in the country to monitor the election. How did the meeting go and what was discussed in order to ensure a smooth working relationship between observers and the Electoral Commission as part of the process to administer a credible election?
We had a briefing meeting yesterday whereby we had more than 140 observers from various observer missions, and we were just briefing them on what we have done and what we expect. And just to give you a hint on what we briefed them, perhaps I will start. We told them about the history of Tanzania, and also we informed them of the electoral system used in Tanzania. Usually the system used in Tanzania is first past the post, whereby a candidate who wins the majority of valid votes is declared the winner. And also we informed them of the women special seats, some sort of proportional representation, whereby parties are allocated the seats depending on the valid votes they acquire. Also we informed them about the functions of the National Electoral Commission. We informed them about the independence of the National Electoral Commission, whereby Article 74, Sub-Article 11 and 12 provides that the commission will work independently without interference or without receiving any directives from government department or a political party. Also, we informed them that the registration of political parties is not under the commission. Rather, it is managed under the Office of the Registrar of Political Parties under the Political Parties Act of 1992, Cap 258.
After the election process, how soon should Tanzanians expect the outcome to be announced by the Electoral Commission?
For the ward councillors, they are announced the very same day on 25th, depending on the geographical location, because it depends on the receiving of the result forms from the polling stations. So for the councillors, we expect to announce the winners on the very same day, at least by evening. Also, in the constituencies, members of parliament, depending on the geographical location, also they will be announced the very same day, at least 25th to 26th. The winners will be declared. And for the presidential elections, we expect to announce the winner at least within 3 days, if all goes well.
As the candidates campaign ahead of the election, there have been reports of tension, although isolated cases of violence here and there. Has the Electoral Commission put in measures in a close collaboration with the security agencies to ensure that before, during, and after the election, violence will be kept to a barest minimum?
Yes, we did that. And normally the commission had to meet stakeholders and the Tanzania police force inclusive, whereby we share what they should do during, before, during, and after election. And during the election, during the poll, we have the police officers who will be taking care of security in those areas. And they should not be around there to scare people, carrying guns and whatnot, but only to be there to see that peace and stability prevails. So they are well informed, and we have a close relationship with them. And also we have a system of incident interaction system whereby incidents with a criminal nature are reported to us and to the police directly. So we hope that everything will be okay as far as security matters are concerned.
Emmanuel Kaweshi is the director of the Legal Services Department of the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir says the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, is being restructured in a bid to register as a political party after the group dissolved its leadership secretariat. But presidential spokesman Atteni Wekatteni told me that dissolving the party leadership is not aimed at pushing Kiir's rivals, including former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar, to form their own parties.
What has happened on Friday is that the National Liberation Council was convened in order to restructure the party in anticipation of registration that is going to take place under the Political Parties Act 2012, which requires all political parties to be registered as a political party in South Sudan. And the SPLM is not registered in South Sudan. It's registered in Khartoum before the independence of South Sudan.
The SPLM in the opposition is saying that this is the latest move by President Salva Kiir to dissolve the party, to have absolute control over the party, basically negating the agreement that was signed in Tanzania to unify the party. What do you say to that?
No, that's not true. President Salva Kiir, you know, himself, you know, he's also affected by this simply because his position is going to be contested in the convention. And if his position is contested, so he's not a free man. So that the SPLM, you know, position says that it is an attempt by him to silence anybody in order to take absolute power. He's not looking for absolute power. President Kiir believes in democracy, and this is the democracy. So the SPLM, you know, position, you know, owing to the fact that they have signed and they didn't come to Juba, you know, the structure of the SPLM cannot wait for them. If they think they are SPLM, they will come and also join the contest during the convention and contest with the president if Riek Machar is willing to come to Juba.
There are suggestions that dissolving the party leadership is aimed at pushing President Kiir's rivals to form their own parties. What do you say to that?
No, that's not true. You know, Koti, what has happened here, you know, Arusha agreement highlighted the fact that, you know, the problem is started within SPLM and that the SPLM has to be brought together and structured together. That is why the SPLM in government, the SPLM IO, and the SPLM political detainees went to Arusha and signed on agreement that they were supposed to start implementing. The government has started to implement it, and that is why Pagan Amom and his colleagues in the LD were reinstated. The IO did not come to Juba yet. And when the agreement was signed, the agreement, the Addis Ababa agreement, that was signed by President Salva Kiir on the 26th, and signed by Riek Machar earlier, before 26th, in August. And Pagan Amom signed. Pagan Amom did not sign as Secretary General of the SPLM, he signed as a leader of the political detainees. Therefore, throwing away the Arusha. He is the one who started throwing away the Arusha. And the agreement he was signing did not give one single provision.
Why would the government go ahead to dissolve this leadership? Why wouldn't they wait? Because an agreement has been signed for an implementation. The first phase will soon be concluded, and then a second phase of a unity government. Why wouldn't this be allowed to rest until all these phases are resolved and a unity government formed before the dissolution of this leadership?
Yeah, first of all, looking at how the turning of events are actually happening, you will see that Riek Machar is reneging from the agreement, and he's no longer going to come to Juba, as anticipated that he would be coming in December, and that the SPLM cannot sit idly in Juba waiting to do practically nothing. So the SPLM is trying to restructure itself and register and continue with the determining its own leadership as a prerequisite for any political party. That if there is any problem that is happening, that the faction of the SPLM are not coming to Juba, you cannot force marriage.
You know very well that if you are saying that Dr. Riek Machar is unwilling to come to Juba by December and that the SPLM doesn't want to sit idle but to go ahead and restructure, that shows bad faith. And people are saying this shows that President Salva Kiir does not want peace, as he pronounces, and that he wants to put obstacles on the way because he is the president and because he doesn't like the deal he signed that he expressed reservations about. So that is why he goes ahead to put obstacles on the way to make things difficult.
These are not to signing the peace agreement with armed opposition or rebels is one thing, and restructuring the party is another. If peace agreement is signed and President Salva Kiir is willing to implement it.
Atteni Wekatteni is the spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Some Zimbabweans have reacted angrily to First Lady Grace Mugabe's outburst during her nationwide political rallies. She has already addressed thousands of people in Mashonaland Central and Manicaland provinces. For VOA, Thomas Chiripasi reports from the capital, Harare.
One of the Harare residents, Nehemiah Mashi, said the First Lady should stop attacking former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, who was expelled from ZANU-PF soon after the ruling party held its Congress at the end of last year for allegedly plotting with her colleagues to topple President Robert Mugabe.
She should be brought to order. She is the wife of the president of this country, and we expect her to lead by example, expect her to respect the electorate.
Thomas Maduku echoed the same sentiments, adding that Mrs. Mugabe's public outbursts against Mrs. Mujuru, journalists and war veterans, are making her to lose her esteemed First Lady status.
It's not right for her to, to shout at people at rallies and stuff. She will end up losing the respect from the people.
Maduku, however, said he supported the First Lady's stance against the corruption that he noted should be nipped in the bud in all structures of government.
On the issue of corruption, she's right, because that's a national problem. I would want her to continue to even raise her voice higher than what she's doing.
Mashi said President Mugabe was no longer in control of the party.
I don't think the old man ordered her to do that, because Mugabe is reserved, Mugabe has good contact.
Another Harare resident, Nkondisi Ndovu said there are indications that Mrs. Mugabe is now preparing to take over power from her husband, and that is why she appears politically agitated.
She's very much prepared to lead. From what we heard during past two rallies, she has been saying that she won't stop and nothing will stop her. And with the financial muscle that she has, I think she's ready to take over.
Independent political analyst Fortune Gwaze shared the same views, noting that there is a lot of factionalism in ZANU-PF.
From what she is saying, and you know, as a constitutional right, she can occupy that office, but what is yet to be seen is whether the people of Zimbabwe and whether the electorate and whether the ZANU-PF itself will allow her to occupy that office.
The First Lady yesterday said Mrs. Mujuru will not get any hero status for allegedly betraying the president. She also expressed dismay over journalists, saying they were writing a lot of lies about her. Some critics are also worried that Mrs. Mugabe may be abusing state resources in her nationwide tour that is similar to the one she conducted before the ZANU-PF Congress last year, in which she attacked Mrs. Mujuru, claiming that she was corrupt, an incapable leader, and power-hungry. Harare resident Dixon Piri is among local people concerned about the First Lady's use of state resources.
It appears as if there are so many people who are now being hoodwinked and being forced or frog-marched into financing Grace Mugabe's rallies.
Mrs. Mugabe is using a military helicopter, state vehicles, and government officers in all her provincial rallies. President Mugabe has told the nation that no one will be able to stop her wife from doing anything, including her political ambitions. Mrs. Mugabe is touted as one of Mr. Mugabe's successors, although she told the world recently that she has no presidential ambitions. From Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Governments, NGOs, and scientists have worked for decades to end hunger and malnutrition by increasing the quantity of food grown. Today, they are trying to improve the nutritional quality of food. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with economist Haworth Boyce, the director of Harvest Plus, a non-profit group that breeds more nutritious plants and shares them with Africa and the world.
Our target is to improve mineral and vitamin intakes. And what distinguishes us is that we're breeding plants to put more minerals and vitamins in the food staples that the poor eat day in and day out.
You're actually creating new kinds of plants, right?
Yes. The way I express it is that we're getting the plants to do the work. There are a couple of advantages using the plant breeding strategy. The first is that we start with the smallholder farmers who are growing the crops that they eat. And when you have the fortified foods that are made in the factories, they often don't reach the rural areas. The second is that it's cost effective. By getting the plants to do the work, once they're in the food system, you don't have recurrent costs. So essentially, the vitamin A and the iron and the zinc is coming free to the households.
Now, is this the same as so-called genetically modified crops?
It's not. We're using conventional plant breeding. We're just crossing high-yielding varieties with the high-nutrient varieties and getting high-yielding, high-nutrient varieties so that we're not using the GMO technology at all.
What is your approach in terms of getting traditional farms to use this? Are there any challenges in terms of getting people on board to actually plant these plants?
Well, we really have two messages for the farmers. The first is that our crops are just as high yielding and just as productive, so you're not sacrificing profits from the crops. They can also be sold in the market. Farmers are always looking for that. But then you get the added value of the extra vitamins and minerals in the crops.
Let me see if I understand what Harvest Plus does more carefully. Is it that you develop these things or you just sort of advocate for them? I mean, what is your involvement in it? A lot of people, obviously are in the business of trying to make food more nutritious.
Well, the plant breeding process takes a while to develop the crops, to do the crossing to get the high yields and the high minerals and vitamins in the crops is an 8 to 10 year process to develop them. Then once they're approved for release in the countries, now we're involved in the job of getting them out to farmers and scaling up. We have the varieties now released in 28 different countries around the world. Now that we're getting the crops out to farmers, we're partnering with NGOs to take our crops and incorporating them in their programs, in the programs of the NGOs, in reaching out to farmers in developing countries. What we're doing now is quite a bit different than when Harvest Plus got started in 2003. So in the beginning, we had to prove that we could develop these crops in high-yielding backgrounds. There was some doubt about that. And we released our first varieties in 2012 in Africa. We also had to do nutrition studies. We had to prove that when vitamin A deficient, iron deficient, zinc deficient people ate our crops, that we could improve their mineral and vitamin status. And now we've done those nutrition studies and we've convinced the nutrition community that we can make a significant contribution to reducing mineral and vitamin deficiencies. Now in the last 2 or 3 years, now that the crops are released, our focus is on extension to farmers and convincing consumers to eat these crops. So we're really into delivery and scaling up now. The governments are really quite excited. Initially, we chose target countries where we introduced a single crop. And in every case, the governments have said, why aren't you bringing all your crops to our country? Why are you just bringing a single crop? It's really gratifying to see all this time and effort that's gone into this starting to have some real impact.
That was Howard Boyes, director of Washington, D.C.-based Harvard Plus. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Meanwhile, last week, an Eritrean football team arrived in Botswana to play in a World Cup qualifying match. But on Wednesday, the 24-man delegation returned to Eritrea with 10 of its members missing. Those who stayed behind sought asylum in Botswana. Reporter Salim Solomon spoke with Augustine Marco Donatortley, Botswana's permanent secretary at the Ministry of Defense, Justice and Security, about the current situation of the Eritrean football asylum seekers.
Yeah, they were moved to some other facility where normally interview asylum seekers.
Who did they first contact? Did they contact the UNHCR?
You must remember that these people were playing football in the evening. Then after the football game, they went to their hotel. And in the night, this 10 just disappeared from their camp. And then having disappeared, it meant that in the morning, we had to go around and look for them. So our police officers went around to look for them and found them somewhere. And it's upon when they were found, when they said, okay, fine, we are here. We don't want to go back to Eritrea. We want to apply for asylum.
Weren't they able to freely move in the first place in their hotel? Why did they have to go run to the police?
Yes. Well, they had been in prison for the past 2 days, almost 2 days. They played football. They were free. They were free in the hotel. They left the hotel because they wanted to leave their compatriots and go and seek asylum. And they went to their colleagues. And their intention was to leave the hotel and run away.
And so what do you see would be the future for the 10 players who are seeking, and a coach, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Well, I can't predict or determine what the outcome would be. All I can say is just to assure you that no, because they have now put their claim application for asylum, they'll be taken through the process like every other person who comes here seeking asylum. So I think we should not panic. We see what the outcome would be. It could be that they could be given, they could be granted or not granted. But of course, we are parties to the UN Convention, and we know that in terms of our obligations, we cannot deport them and take them back to their country of origin. Mm-hmm. If anything, we can look for other durable solutions. Well, there's a solution of giving refugee status, the solution of resettlement to a third country, another third country, with the help of the UNHCR. I think we work together and see what durable solutions we can do. Like in all other ordinary cases that we handle in this country, we haven't gone through the law. And like every other case of applications for asylum, we will go through all the processes and procedures that are laid down in the law.
Augustine Makotano-Trotley, Botswana's Permanent Secretary at the Ministry of Defense, Justice and Security, spoke with reporter Salim Solomon from the capital, Habaroni. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, October 18th. We have plenty of football news today, starting with the 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile. The 16th edition of the two-yearly tournament started off on Saturday, and will run through November 8th. Four African representatives are among the 24 teams featuring in the Under-17 World Cup. They are defending champion Nigeria, Guinea, Mali, and South Africa. On the opening day, two African teams, Nigeria and Guinea, tested action, and the outcome was not bad. Nigeria started the defense of his title on a good note when he defeated the United States 2-0. Chukwu Diago grabbed the opener in the 58th minute, while Victor Osimhen completed the scoring 11 minutes later. Nigeria is on top of Group A on 3 points, followed by Croatia and Chile on 1 point each way. In the second match of the day involving an African team, Guinea managed to salvage a point when it played 1-1 with England in Group B. England took the lead in the 61st minute, and it was not until 15 minutes later that Guinea drew level, thanks to Nabi Bangura. Mali will test action later today, Sunday, when it takes on Belgium in Group D's opening game. Africa's number 4 team, South Africa, will be in action on Monday against Costa Rica in Group E. In more football news, the first round of the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup has been concluded. The qualifiers include Niger, a 6-0 aggregate winner over Somalia, Mauritania, which scored an aggregate 5-1 win over South Sudan, Namibia, a 3-2 aggregate winner over Gambia, Ethiopia, which won 3-1 on aggregate over Sao Tome and Principe, Chad, which defeated Sierra Leone on the away goal rule after the two teams deadlocked 2-2 on aggregate, and Comoros, also a winner on the away goal rule after an aggregate 1-1 deadlock against Lesotho. Others are Swaziland, Botswana, Burundi, Liberia, Madagascar, Kenya, and Tanzania. The 13 teams will join the 27 that drew a bye into the second round, making a total of 40 teams. Staying with football, the first leg of the final qualifying matches for the 2016 African Nations Championships are being played in some zones this weekend. In Zone West B, Nigeria defeated visiting Burkina Faso 2-0 in the southern oil city of Port Harcourt, while host Niger beat Togo by the same scoreline in the capital city of Niamey. Both matches were played on Saturday. The return leg will be played in Ouagadougou next week, with the overall winner picking the tickets to the tournament finals in Rwanda next year. Let's remind our listeners that the African Nations Championship is for players in the continent's domestic leagues. Meanwhile, Burkina Faso's coach Traore Drissa has blamed his team for the loss to Nigeria. Here is Traore speaking through an interpreter after the match.
Bon, mon impression, je pense que nous avons joué un match.
He says that his first impression was that they played the match and they made the match so easy for Nigeria. At a point in the game, their team suffered loss of concentration and that gifted the match to Nigeria. He says even the first goal, you could clearly see that it wasn't really because the Super Eagles were playing very well, but it was simply because of miscommunication and lack of concentration in his team that gifted the goal, because we had 3 defenders against 2 strikers, but they still succeeded in scoring.
That was Burkina Faso's coach Traore Drissa. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt. And in the Central East zone of the Nations Championship qualifiers, also on Saturday, Uganda defeated Sudan 2-0, while Burundi beat Ethiopia by the same goal margin. 16 teams, including host Rwanda, which is an automatic qualifier, will feature in the final of the 2016 African Nations Championship, which will be the fourth edition. Libya won the 2014 edition of the tournament, which was hosted by South Africa. Finally, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, says the organization is still working well in operational terms, despite the 90-day suspension of President Sepp Blatter. FIFA's acting Secretary General, Marcus Kuttner, made the pronouncement in a statement on Thursday. Issa Hayatou, who is interim FIFA president, agrees with Kuttner, saying the world body remains focused on its reform process and the forthcoming presidential election. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll hook up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Step ku step nga tambuka, hey, kame se tambula, omanye ngeri je tweyisa, kali gwera mweyo, muga katonda, poluke dele tubala, mulavu nge tungo ya goya, ah, yeah, 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 ay, sikuli mande mukatu mulavu mukwane ngo ya goya, sikuli mbengo ya goya, Katwengo ya goya Echuma chaka soli mbachi tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Dimu katwengo ya goya Nakula ndi wa malonyo Ono ya mponye chalo Omanye vinye watavi woma Gabia mpulungu se Nebo vikube noga Muli oulira tebitambula Sawa kwa tano labo muka Wabula mulido Lyato lya injini Terimanya mayengo Woma nyivo mkwata Evi omu kwa noto vipapira Masigansuwa Evi omu kwa no mpola mpola Mama mpola mpola Tipigite Sikuli mande mkatu mulavu Mkwa nengo ya goya Sikuli mengo ya goya Katwengo ya goya Echuma chaka soli mbachi tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Limu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Oh, nasala wo Ya mkwata ni mkwata la avu Ya mfunza funza msonda Tuka ya chipoli Eno lafu Etamanya tioline chitiva Enfuga vya chila lulavu Zentide walai Chaka soli mbachi tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbande mkatu mulavu Mkwa mbengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Echumba chaka soli mbachi tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Engo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Engo ya goya
Yeah!
ubetani maboko. C'était ma mon Kili Mobimba. Et au numéro 9, Samuel Eto'o.
Sa vie, l'hypocrisie, la jalousie, ton sort, j'en ai pas envie. L'amour et la haine vont de pair. La haine et l'amour, quel duo d'enfer. Je suis seul l'autre, sans l'une l'autre, on ne pénètre. L'autre là, l'autre là, à quoi ça sert? Tout ce que l'on perd, il n'y a rien à faire. La terre est mon repère. L'autre là, signé mon part. Laurent Lorenzo, ouais. Yambaloyo, yaka bena litaka. Toko motale na makambango bena likolo. Ah, goda mutemona. Martin écran, l'écran géant.
Oui, maman, y'a ma toto, signore. Béa,
béa.
Si tu vas les gars, y'a ma toto. Éliqué,
béa, béa.
Walter Mouniania. Y'a ma toto.
Béa, béa.
Nico, et petit béa. Béa,
béa.
Edia Taba, Ones, Makia, dit papa Jonathan.
Automatique, le fête, son homolo.
Sortina, nos séries, si coca, tu sais baléter. Colo, baka, ma béa, gandote. Bayaka fleur d'amour, Gofen Kanga.
Voilà un ami, la nage gwede un ami.
Marie-Louise
Mouni.
Baby.
Papa Morgan. Zulizule mazuanga bien.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, a political committee of the African National Congress, ANC, recommended that the South African government should withdraw from the International Criminal Court, ICC. This should not have come as any surprise to those who have been following the game being played by the ICC. The saga between the ICC and the African states have been long and complicated. It was owing to to the overwhelming support of African states to end impunity for violation of crimes against humanity that made it possible for the ICC to exist in the first place. And those who are enthusiasts of the ICC today, in fact, did not even sign the Rome Statute or are not members of the ICC. What happened then was that the African states became gradually disillusioned with the practice and policy of the ICC. Instead of looking at crimes against humanity on a wider basis, the ICC, since its establishment, had focused primarily on Africans and the African continent. And beyond that, the ICC, through its chief prosecutors, have arrogantly ignored the views and opinions of African states and African institutions. For example, when the African Union called on the ICC to postpone or defer the arrest warrant against the president of Sudan, they said no. When the African Union appealed to the ICC or the Security Council not to proceed at an early stage with the prosecution of the leaders in Kenya, again, they arrogantly said no. And worst of all, when after a difficult negotiations, the head of the Lord's Resistance Union, Kony, was to come and sign an agreement, and they asked for a release for him to sign, the chief prosecutor at the time said no, even though the president of Uganda, the people who are the victims in the north of Uganda wanted it. And what are the results? Kony and his group are now killing more and more victims in Central Africa. So it was not a surprise, because African states, the African Union, had called on all Africans not to cooperate with the ICC. But the ICC represents a crisis in the governance of international institutions, but mostly after the end of the Cold War. Now, a group of states have actually captured these institutions, and the African voice is no longer as vibrant as it used to be. So I think that Africans should follow the example of South Africa if they withdraw. But I know Africa, and it will not be an easy thing because of the overdependence on the largesse of other countries. Africans are not free to make their own independent decisions. So if they should try to do that, the pressure will come to bear on them to tell them, if you do this, this will be the consequences. So I am not confident that many Africans would follow the example of South Africa should they decide to withdraw. But this is the bane of Africa of today, that the overdependence on outside forces has made the country less independent and therefore has to follow the lead of others. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Impuga, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the habit of thinking is the habit of gaining strength. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Angola hosted an international conference on maritime and energy security in the Gulf of Guinea from October 7th to the 9th. In an op-ed published October 8th in the Journal de Angola, U.S. Ambassador to Angola Helen Lalima wrote, "This conference is unique and especially important because it brings together public and private stakeholders from the global maritime and energy sectors and enables them to share international best practices in order to improve regional security coordination and strengthen public-private security partnerships." The Gulf of Guinea is one of the most dynamic regions in the global energy sector and is of critical importance for the economic development of much of the Atlantic coast of Africa. Revenues derived from hydrocarbons provide many African states in the region with a strong financial base to fund development initiatives. Also, many of the trade routes connecting Africa with the rest of the world pass through the Gulf of Guinea. Over the past 2 years, the states of West and Central Africa have demonstrated commitment to support and protect the development of the blue economy. The 2013 Declaration of the Heads of State and Government of Central and West African States on Maritime Safety and Security in their Common Maritime Domain, also known as the Yaoundé Code of Conduct, represents a pioneering framework to collaborate, cooperate, and share information. The conference provided an opportunity for senior officials from the Gulf of Guinea region to develop strategies to improve maritime safety and security. The focus was on interagency coordination, cooperative mechanisms between state institutions and private sector stakeholders, and preparedness for potential maritime emergencies. At the regional level, the conference was an important step in the implementation of the 2013 Yaoundé Code of Conduct. The United States, Ambassador Lalima noted, "We can and should continue to work so that the security and protection of the oceans of this beautiful continent become a reality."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.